Hello, my name's Steve Wasserman, and welcome to another session from Short Story Masterclass, talking with great short story writers about the craft and even the craftiness of the modern short story. I'm here in Charleston at Small Wonder, a whole festival dedicated to short stories, and a delight that is too. It's a sunny Sunday morning, and I'm talking to Deborah Levy about her jewel-like short story, Placing a Call. Just six paragraphs, 633 words in total, which she's going to read to us first before we get stuck in with talk about why and how she writes.
Placing a call. You are telling me something I don't want to hear. You are telling me the honest truth. We are standing in the garden and it is dusk. There are rain clouds in the sky and midges, and someone is planting a rose bush in the garden next door. The telephone is ringing. I run into the house and pick up the receiver. The telephone is pressed against my ear. Someone is calling and I am answering. I am saying hello into hard black plastic. But I hear the dial tone and the ringtone happening at the same time. Someone is missing. Someone is trying to get through. And then I remember there's a bird in the garden that imitates a telephone when it sings. I can see it now in the tree in the garden where you are telling me the honest truth. It is singing in an old-fashioned ringtone. It is singing like a landline. I run back into the garden. We are standing in the garden and it's autumn, and there's a bird in the tree that imitates a telephone when it sings. Your hair is silver, but you are not old. Under your soft silver hair is your skull, with your central nervous system inside it. It is dusk, and it has started to rain. The roots of the eucalyptus tree that grows in the garden are spreading under the house. Our daughter is sleeping inside the house, under a photograph of the sea. She is covered in a thick blanket. Her bed stands on a green carpet. There are two stains on the carpet. You are wearing a white shirt and a suit, and under your soft silver hair is your skull. While you speak the honest truth, I am thinking about the time we ate horse steaks in Paris. The waiter served the dish of the day, and the dish of the day was horse. It was like eating a unicorn in the 21st century. My iPod was playing a song we'd never heard before. You untangled the headphones and pressed them into your ears, and you lifted my fingers and pressed them into your mouth. But now we are standing in the garden, and the telephone bird has stopped making calls no one answers. The car alarms and police sirens have stopped too. Silence is cruel in cities where missing people need to hide in noise. But we are standing in the garden in the rain, and you have not stopped telling me the honest truth. And I wonder if the telephone bird will one day learn to sing computer startup sounds. Your silver hair is wet. Our daughter is pretending to sleep inside the house under a photograph of the sea. And she's listening to the rain, which always makes sorrow bigger and hard things softer. I walk towards you, bumping into things on the way. Kissing you is like new paint and old pain. It is like coffee and car alarms and a dim stairway and a stain, and it's like smoke. I am looking into your eyes, and I can't get in. You have changed the locks, and I have an old key that doesn't fit. And our daughter is making her way across the garden towards us, holding her thick blanket. You are telling me you are dead, and I say, yes, I know you are. We miss you, and since you've gone, I've forgotten all my PIN numbers. I can't remember the code to my gym locker, or where the honey is, or where I put the blue pillowcase. And could you tell me, again, where exactly the sea is in that photograph?
Thank you. So, this is a really an incredible short story, I think. It's it has formal elegance, density, and a lot of elusiveness. I suppose the first question I wanted to ask you was, what for you makes this a short story rather than a poem? Because I could imagine that this would work equally well as a poem.
Yes, it's one of the short stories in this collection, Black Vodka, that still surprises me when I read it. I'm not sure whether it surprises me in a good way or a bad way. There's another way that a short story writer could approach this. It was a sunny day and she decided to go into the garden. Ooh, there were some black clouds above her head she hadn't noticed, etc., etc. And you pull in weather as metaphor for some kind of emotional state and all of that. But when I was writing this, I definitely thought it was a short story and not a poem. It's written across the page and it's prose and it's led by voice, that's for sure. There are three characters and an object, actually two objects, a telephone and a photograph. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to see if I could create an enigma in this short story that was also very straightforward in a way.
It becomes more straightforward towards, I think, in that last paragraph, but you're right, it is very enigmatic to begin with.
Yeah. So that she is talking to a ghost. And what I was thinking about there were two things. One was a friend who had lost a beloved person to her, and she told me, oh, I talk to him all the time, my lips move like a prayer. People think I'm religious, they think I'm praying, and we talk all the time. And that really struck me. And I was also thinking about the living dead, when a love affair is over, mm-hmm. and when love has died, and the locks have changed, and we don't have a way of kind of opening the door, it's closed, and we want to, you know, when we fall out of love, it really is a fall, and we're not quite sure where we're going to land. And so I wanted to explore that in the story. And then I also wanted to up the stakes, and I guess this is where the craft of short fiction comes in. Why does this matter? Well, there have to be consequences for something to matter. And so there's a child sleeping in the story.
Pretending to sleep. She too is traumatized, upset, perhaps.
We don't know. Mm. She's sleeping under a blanket and there's a photograph of the sea. And perhaps it's a place that she visited with her father. That's for the reader to fill in. So it's a story because it has consequences. It's a story because it...
And you don't feel a poem has that level of consequentiality as a story?
Not quite in the same way. I'm sure there probably are many poems that do. But not for me, no. I think there's a different touch in a poem. A poem can, in a way, maybe have more symbols in it, where this is really a straightforward, it's quite straightforward in its enigmatic way. I'm always very interested in how David Lynch uses enigma in his films, but they set in very particular places with quite defined characters. You know, Lynch is interested in character. So in Blue Velvet, we have two teenagers who trying to figure out why the world's so bad. But he always creates an enigma, and he will always start with something quite, if you like, surreal, but straightforward. I think Blue Velvet starts with a severed ear found in a field. So that kind of approach to unfolding a fiction, it really interests me.
And in a way, I think you do something similar. I mean, because there is, I think, a Lynchian tone to this story. In a way, you do something similar with some of the little details that you drop in. I mean, for example, the two stains on the carpet. There's something about this. There's something kind of slightly, a little bit creepy about those, and we start wondering what are those two stains about? You know, yeah. What do they represent?
So if we're talking about short fiction, they're there to suggest a past, because this is all told in the present, although the past is referred to when we are in Paris and they're eating horse steaks. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at how time is going to move through this short fiction. And the stains on the carpet are there to create a past. What happened? That's why they're there.
Mm. I love that. I was just going to, just because you mentioned the horse steaks, that's probably my favourite line in the story. It was like eating a unicorn in the 21st century. I love that line, and I love the fact that you've got this sort of ethereal, it could be a ghost story, and yet you root it very, very much in the present as well. How do you feel about that? I mean, you know, you talk about an iPod. The iPod is obviously on shuffle because it's playing a song we'd never heard before. Do you sort of consciously do that?
Yes. I want the contemporary world in my stories. And also, if we're going to do strange things with consciousness, if I'm going to put it like, I'll put it like that, then we have to... we have to have concrete things in it. We have to know, there's an iPod. And then we have the horse steaks, which, I remember eating a horse steak in Paris and discovering that it was horse. And thinking, yes, it's such a huge mythic beast. I feel the same about swordfish. If you see those, they're creeping into my next novel, actually. They've got such long swords, 6 foot, something like that, and bright blue eyes. So, yes, we're in a garden. We're in a city. It's raining. A child is asleep. A landline is ringing. I'm always interested in the way birds imitate technology. There was a bird in my garden that imitated a landline, and I kept thinking the phone was ringing, kept running in to answer it. So
you've sort of brought all of these things together, which is another element, I think, often to your prose, that it's very much almost like a dream. And of course, this is how the mind puts together dreams, doesn't it? It takes all of these elements from real, in inverted commas, life, and it mixes them up in a way to sort of form a kind of inner golem.
I wonder if it is like a dream. And that has been said quite often about my work, and perhaps it's fair enough. I don't think I approach it like that. Dreams, such an important part of, and such an exciting part of our lives. On the whole, anything can happen in a dream and it won't have consequences. And in fiction, stuff happens. We risk things. We have the odd moment of, blazing courage or terrible cowardice. And if they didn't have consequences, there would be nothing to write about. So instead of perhaps dreamlike, I would say that my fiction is layered And it's always kind of... I like J.G. Ballard's quote when he was asked... he was sort of framed as a science fiction writer in the 50s and when he was writing his early short stories because he couldn't get them published. But he could get them published as science fiction. But later on, he said, you know, I'm much more interested in... inner worlds than outer worlds. No, J.G. Ballard said, I'm much more interested in inner space than outer space. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in them both, and I'm interested in that journey sometimes happening at the same time. So so layered rather than dreamlike, I think.
And what I also wanted to, having just read your... longish essay, Things I Don't Want to Know, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I suppose, different layers of motivation, or if we can even use the sort of the Freudian term of drives that get you writing. I mean, it feels to me there's an interesting tie-in here between this story and Things I Don't Want to Know, because, you know, things I don't want to hear are often things I don't want to know, aren't they?
I called my long autobiographical essay Things I Don't Want to Know because they are the things I usually end up writing about. Mm-hmm. Things I Don't Want to Know are quite different from the things perhaps we don't want to... what's another way of putting it? Things I Don't Want to Know... The things I don't want to know are usually the things I know anyway, but don't want to think about it. So in that Freudian sense, they're the things that have been repressed. And we all have those moments, you know, we walk into the bus stop and we think about a conversation the night before and we try to re-edit it because we don't come out very well in it. We make these little editorial corrections and then we think, oh... I don't want to know that. And you kind of try and think about something else. So things I don't want to know are the things that I usually wind up writing about. Mm. And if we've been talking about
the
dreams.
The honest truth, to refer to that very interesting phrase from the story that feels almost syllogistic in a way, the honest truth.
Yes.
There's something about that phrase.
Well, you're right to pick up on that, because whenever anyone says, I'm going to tell you the honest truth, it usually isn't. you know, it's a contradiction, the honest truth, isn't it? So they're usually not going to tell you the honest truth. They're going to tell you how they see things and in quite a didactic way. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, I wanted to play with that and actually make it something that was unbearably honest in the story, Placing a Call. Mm-hmm. The essay... is a response to George Orwell's 1946 essay, Why I Write. It's also a conversation with Virginia Woolf's essay, A Room of One's Own. I hitched a ride on Orwell's four headings to sum up his own motivation.
Yes, I was going to ask you about those, because his four headings are... sheer egoism in this order. Sheer egoism, aesthetic enthusiasm, historical impulse and political purpose. And just in terms of word count, I noticed that the greater part of your book appears to be skewed towards historical impulse, then political purpose, then very briefly sheer egoism and aesthetic enthusiasm. And I was wondering if, in fact, is that how it stacks up for you in terms of your motivation to write?
That's a fair question. No, I don't think that I've made this chronological and prioritized one of those headings above another. And actually, they all kind of seep into each other, so that in political purpose, there's quite a lot of aesthetic pleasure. And in sheer egoism, there's quite a lot of political purpose. So although I've divided them up, they're all in conversation with each other all the time. Historical impulse is the longest, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was very difficult to write. I thought, well, if I'm going to steal another writer's heading, I've got to be truthful. That was important. And I decided that I would finally write about my childhood in South Africa. I left when I was 9 and have lived in the UK ever since. And so that was tough. I wasn't sure anyone would want to read it. I've never really wanted to write about it. But it's important also in its structural relationship to the beginning, because we have a middle-aged woman weeping on escalators. And so the reader becomes a kind of detective gathering clues for for these tears. Well, what's going on? And what's happened on those escalators is that the past has come back to chase the narrator. And the past is Africa and the African childhood. So we have the past sort of making itself present in London on an escalator, on a tube station, 40 years later.
And was this your recognition at the time that in some way whatever distress you were feeling in the present was intrinsically connected to these past events?
Not immediately. But that began to become clear. I think there's a line in Things I Don't Want to Know, which is, if I didn't want to read my mind was reading me. I'm also dramatizing theory in Things I Don't Want to Know. So it operates as an essay. Some of it is autobiographical, the middle section. I was very struck by a quote by Nietzsche, something like he'd come to the conclusion. Let's have a look at it.
I've gradually come to understand what every great philosophy until now has been: the confession of its author and a kind of involuntary, unconscious memoir.
Yes.
And I was going to ask you, because I just love the term involuntary, unconscious memoir. If in a way. This clearly is, but also if some way the stories, and in fact all of your work, your plays and novels, could be read in some sense as an involuntary, unconscious memoir.
It sounds good on the page, doesn't it? We have to say that Nietzsche came to a bit of a sticky end.
Yes, with the horse.
With the horse. Ah, there we go, you see. The horse has galloped back. A horse was being beaten in Turin, I think, and Nietzsche couldn't bear the sight of that.
And he cruelty. began to sob uncontrollably as well. Yeah.
So there we go. There we have Nietzsche saying something so profoundly interesting, that all great philosophy is an involuntary, unconscious memoir. And I found that very touching, actually, because it makes philosophy much less abstract. Much less abstract, much less patriarchal, if you like. It brings it home. Mm-hmm. I thought it was true. Some of my work would be vaguely autobiographical, so sometimes, acutely so, but certainly not all of it. I think when I write short fiction, I think I use short fiction a bit like a camera. They're photographs for me. It's as if the mind takes a photograph and then I kind of think, well, what's going on in that image? What's actually happening?
I'd like to bring you to a passage of bullet points to a certain extent, which fascinated me in the sense of giving me a sense of your motivation, part of what is your motivation to write and then to become the writer you have become, But also I think it's actually probably key, it's a more universal motivation. I'm just thinking about this passage here. This is when you're 7 years old, is that right? And you're 7 years old, you're at this convent school in Durban, and you're living with your godmother. And I wonder if you could just read that passage.
Yes, so this is from Things I Don't Want to Know. Okay. I had been told to say my thoughts out loud and not just in my head, but I decided to write them down. It was 5 in the morning and I could hear Rory barking at the reed frogs in the pond. I found a biro and had a go at writing down my thoughts. What came out of the biro and onto the page was more or less everything I did not want to know. Dad disappeared, Tandiwi cried in the bath, Pete's got a hole in his head, Joseph's fingers got bitten off, Mr. St. Clair hit my legs, the watermelons grew and I wasn't there, Maria and Mom are far away, Sister Joan might not believe in God, Billy Boy the budgie behind bars.
What I'm really fascinated with is what you describe as a seven-year-old child, that, as I say, that impulse to put down on paper, to kind of make safe in a way, or certainly contain in some sense, some of these perhaps slightly intolerable feelings. I'm wondering if that is still the impulse with which you sit down and do your best writing now.
Well, I think all my writing is to dig for unconscious motivation. It's not just personal, this. It's cultural. It's psychological. You know, you can look at an advert and you think, what's it trying to do? So unconscious motivation is a sort of maybe... a posh way of putting it. But what's it trying to do? What's all that language trying to do? It's trying to get me to buy sugar. Or it's trying to make women feel unclean in some way. So we're all reading our world and we all are listening quite hard to language anyway. You don't have to be a writer to be doing that. And then you were talking about Lacan earlier, Jacques Lacan, and he has this lovely, lovely phrase. He says, what we want to do is find the connection between Mondays and potatoes. So we're trying to find how one thing, all of us, I'm using we, because we don't have to be writers, to try and figure how one thing connects to another. So, you know, if we slam a door and we're not quite sure what we're so angry about. Mm-hmm. And that reveals itself to us slowly, perhaps, throughout the day. Well, I'm interested in that slow reveal. I'm not interested in sort of knowing everything immediately in a fiction, because I don't think that's how we know things. So it's always the unconscious motivation of something. It's always concrete. It's always rooted, my fiction, in more or less in the contemporary world.
And I think that slow reveal, I think that's a lovely way to describe also what happens in the story, because there is this sense of, to begin with, when one is reading it, a sense of, you know, where am I? Who are these people? What is, as you say, there's that enigma. Is he missing? Is he dead? Has he betrayed her in some way? And then this occurs over the next 633 words.
Yeah. Yes. And I also, I'm not a fan of giving too much information. I think that perhaps the craft of short fiction, but all fiction, is giving the reader enough information to fill in the gaps that are left in any piece of writing. That's a real pleasure. That's the pleasure of reading, actually. So that the reader, as much as the writer, is kind of enjoying the, I don't want to use the journey, is enjoying the enigma. Enigmas are supposed to be bad things. We're supposed to explain ourselves all the time. We live in a culture of, you know, over explanation, and yet that's not how we experience ourselves or other people. So it's interesting that so much fiction, in my view, leaves nothing, leaves very little for the reader to do. So I'm absolutely interested in finding narrative strategies that encourage our curiosity and sometimes bewilder us on the way.
Well, let's hope your curiosity has been encouraged after listening to this conversation, or at the very least, fruitfully bewildered. Many thanks to Deborah once again for speaking so passionately about her craft to me. Also, thank you, Neve Pierce and Diana Reich at Small Wonder for sorting out the logistics. And a huge thank you to Alison McLeod at Chichester for inviting us to talk. Speak to you soon. Bye.
To become a writer, I had to learn to interrupt, to speak up, to speak a little louder, and then louder, and then just to speak in my own voice, which is not loud at all.